Good evening, 7 o'clock. Now, let's do that again. Good evening, 7 o'clock. Hey, it's good to see you. A couple of weeks back, I started talking about the world's largest religious festival that I had the privilege of visiting. It was called the Kumbh Mela. And so there's a picture of it. The Kumbh Mela was in rural northern India. It was outside the city of Allahabad, and I'll point it out, it's where the two great rivers in India meet. The top one that goes down to the bottom right, that's the Ganges or Ganga River, and the bottom left coming up to the middle, that's the Yamuna River. They're kind of special places for Hindus. We visited myself, a couple of theologians, a cultural anthropologist, and a philosophy professor. We visited the Kumbh Mela, and it was a place where 250 million Hindus were visiting between January 15 through to March 15 this year. So we went on a day where there are only 5 million people in a 10 square kilometre grid. And if you're a clean freak, that kind of doesn't work well for your brain, because in rural India where things don't flush or get washed, yeah, it's really disgusting. There was one point where we had to walk through a temple to get through to where we wanted to go. And we had to walk barefooted through this temple. So you got to take your boots off and walk barefooted where 5 million other people had walked through. And it's dark and it's kind of on gritty, slushy floors. And the worst thing is that we walked through things that still give me nightmares. And the other thing was, at the end of the temple, we had to put our boots back on again. That was disgusting. Anyway, if you're a clean freak, that doesn't work. But you can imagine hundreds and hundreds, thousands and thousands, millions and millions of Hindus following their guru down to the water's edge so they can get into that special part of the river, wash themselves in the hope of what they believed in Hindu culture, they believed would be washing away all their past and present sins, breaking the karmic cycle, so that if they died there and then on the spot, they would go straight to heaven. The scary thing is that if there are 5 to 35 million people there in a day, if they actually believe that they go to heaven as soon as they die, so if you drop dead, they left you there in the water. So it's that kind of scary, weird, bizarre thing, but 250 million Hindus believe that. And there are 1 billion Hindus in the world, 750 million who live in India. And that's just one of the main religions in the world. Now, there are 5 main religions we know of. That's Hinduism, Islam, Judaism, Christianity, Buddhism. And that's not to mention that all the religions, those main ones, they actually have variations inside each of those religions. So think just for Christianity for just for a moment. If you're a Christian, you can either be a Catholic, an Evangelical, an Anglican, a Baptist, a Presbyterian, a Pentecostal, and the list goes on. With so many different flavours of religions, with a seemingly infinite number of tracks cut through humanity's spiritual path, little wonder people just say, I give up. Surely all religions just lead to the same place, right? And to be completely honest, you don't have to go very far to see every single religion and every single variation of every religion on earth. You just have to go down your street. Like, I'm just going to talk about my street that I live in. I live in Castle Hill on a crescent. If I walk down my street, there are Christians, there are Catholics, there are Hindus, there are Buddhists, there are atheists. And that's just my street. What about your street? Wherever you go, whether it be in your streets, in your workplaces, in your gyms, in your universities, in your schools, the person who serves you coffee, your clients, your workmates, your friends. These are the people we're talking about. And the statistics support what we all know to be true. You look at the growth in non-Christian religions in Australia over the last 25 years, with so many different people believing countless different dogma, worshipping a pantheon of different gods, following a myriad of different religious customs. Surely any well-thinking human would just accept them all as valid and think, surely all religions lead to heaven, right? So today, we're asking and answering the very real question of, what do I say when someone says all roads lead to heaven? And when we ask that question, we're continuing in on our series, the apologetic series. And remember, apologetics is about defending the Christian faith. When someone intentionally or out of curiosity asks something about Christianity, when we as Christians respond, we are engaging in apologetics. And a key passage to help us understand apologetics is 1 Peter chapter 3, verse 15. Peter writes, "In your heart set apart Christ as Lord. Always be prepared to give an answer to everyone who asks you to give the reason for the hope that you have." Now, this series is about getting a better answer than one where we just avoid the issue or dismiss the issue or make the issue worse. And we want to have better answers because better answers give us better responses, which ultimately help us talk about Jesus. So the plan for tonight is very simple. Three things we're looking at tonight. The first is we're looking at the key apologetic issue. And the apologetic issue we're looking at tonight is religious pluralism. I'm going to hopefully give you a simple 30-second sample response that will get the ball rolling in helping you develop answers when someone asks you these questions. And the third thing we're doing tonight is taking a deeper look at the issue from Jesus' own words. So let's gear our minds. Let's look at the first thing, the key apologetic issue tonight. At one level, when you see all those world religions and all those different people around you, many people unthinkingly and flippantly just say, "They're all the same. Who cares?" But I reckon you and I, we know that's not the case anymore. You and I, we talk to people who are much more sophisticated than that. Because the people that you and I talk to, yeah, they say, yeah, Judaism's different to Buddhism, which is different to Islam, which is different to Christianity, but they're not all the same. They know that. But what they say is this: they want to affirm that somehow all these different religions are ultimately united. This kind of logic comes from the thinking, and it's often called religious pluralism. And religious pluralism is defined by saying spiritual truth is plural in form and not singular. So religious pluralism is just saying there are lots of different religious truth out there, not just one. So tonight, when we talk about religious pluralism, I want you to think about the kind of ways it's expressed in Australia nowadays. One way it's expressed is when people simply say religions are different paths up the same mountain. Or they'll say, well, as all roads lead to Rome, so all religions lead to God. That is religious pluralism. And I'm sure we've had those conversations where people say those kinds of things, and it's a very powerful point of view. You might be sitting there tonight thinking, well, that's what I think. That's my perspective on all religions. And Professor John Hick, he was a guy that actually pushed this very strongly through Christian circles over the last 30 years. He wrote a book called The Rainbow of Faith, and he explains religious pluralism by letting us look at this picture, this optical illusion. So as you see that, you should see two different pictures, and that's an optical illusion. On one angle, you see a duck, and you'll also see a rabbit as well, a rabbit sort of lying back like that. If you can see a horse or a dinosaur, then we need to talk about it because it's not there. You can only see a duck or a rabbit, okay? So as Professor Hickey showed this picture, and he said, well, imagine if I conducted an experiment and I showed this optical illusion to people who had only ever seen ducks and never seen rabbits. What would they see? They would see ducks. And then if I showed that very same picture to people who had only ever seen rabbits and never seen a duck, then what would they see? Well, they'll only see rabbits. Then he asked the question, so which group is correct? Well, Professor John Hick says both groups are correct.
Both are entirely justified, and the contradiction that we see between the opinions is just the perception rather than the substance. So Professor John Hick compares religious truth with this optical illusion. He says, all those great religions of the world, they contain merely perceptions of reality. And each perspective, each perception is culturally determined, just as the duck-knowing group would only see ducks, and just as the rabbit-knowing group would only see rabbits. So, well, Buddhists, well, they would see Buddha. Hindus would see Brahma. Muslims would see Allah. Christians, well, they should see the Trinity. No one's wrong, he says. It's just cultural perception. It's all just ducks and rabbits. And this view is becoming really, really popular in Australia. There are three very quick reasons why this view is becoming popular. The first reason why religious pluralism is attractive is because it fits perfectly into our current postmodern worldview. This worldview of postmodernism says truth is no longer absolute. Truth is subjective. What you believe is all relative, depending on your individual preference, traditions, cultural values and beliefs. So if all roads lead to heaven, who cares, they say, because they believe whatever you like, it all goes to the same place. In fact, if you take a bit out of every single religion, that's okay, because if they all lead to the same place, it doesn't matter. That's cultural relativism and postmodernism. Another reason why religious pluralism is attractive is because it allows people to stay in a comfortable position of agnosticism. That is, when you're an agnostic, you say, well, because I can't know for certain, then I can't really ever commit to anything. Because I can't know if God exists for certain, then how can I ever commit to God? And if God does exist, how can I ever know and be certain that I can even know him? So therefore, I'm going to be agnostic and not commit. So religious pluralism sort of panders to that kind of agnosticism, and it throws anything into the too hard basket. So basically it comes down to, surely it's just too hard. I can't really know, so I'm going to grab a beer, I'm going to kick back on my couch, turn the TV on and watch the soccer. And hopefully no one asks any questions, and all these annoying sort of questions about religion and God, they just go away. That's what agnosticism is. Another reason why religious pluralism is attractive is that it comes across as being humble and inoffensive. It's just so politically correct to be a religious pluralist nowadays. It is. It's so much easier to be someone who comes across as humble, acknowledging your limits of knowledge, acknowledging that presuppositions dictate our point of view. It's so much easier to just shut down any discussion or pretend we can't engage in it because we can't know, rather than being one of those Christians who are arrogant and cultural imperialists. Now tonight I want to contend that as Christians we can be humble and acknowledge our human finiteness and our philosophical presuppositions, but still be able to make a coherent response in this world. As Christians, we don't need to come across as arrogant. We don't need to come across as narrow-minded, because the people we're talking to, they're our close friends. They're our family. They're the people that we love and care for and have lots of fun with. So we need to be kind, gracious, compassionate, respectful. And when we do these things, like trying to get answers to these kind of tough questions, we're not looking for magic bullets or one-size-fits-all answers, but we are looking at ways to get a better answer. A better answer. Last 2 weeks ago, I pointed out that one of the tips that I'm going to come from comes from John Dixon, and he's one of the great apologists in the Australian Church, and this is why he deals with apologetics. He takes the question and answers it briefly by recounting something that Jesus said or did. So that's a model that we're going to look at, the model of how we're going to get the answer. So with all that in mind, how might you respond when someone says, all roads lead to heaven? This is what I'll say. I understand what you're saying, but I just want you to know that as a Christian, I don't think I know it all, not at all. We simply look at Jesus' life and find ourselves convinced by what he did and taught. And Jesus made some very unique claims. One time, when asked about the way to God, Jesus said, I am the way, the truth, and the life. No one comes to the Father except through me. And later on, Jesus said, if you've seen me, you've seen the Father. Now, Jesus alone, of all the great religious founders, said that he himself was God's very own revelation. So people don't need to look to religion or rely on guesswork. They can just look at Jesus and what he was like to see what God was like. And for me, that is the great difference. That's what separates Jesus from every other religion. Now think about that response for a minute, just for a couple of seconds, and think, how would that go down if I said that, if someone asked me that question? Would it work? Would it get it start? Would it get the conversation started? Or would it just shut everything down and hopefully goes away? Well, I want to contend that if we start having answers like that, pointing to Jesus, the answers are not dismissive, they don't avoid the issue, and they actually humbly answer people's concerns. So far, we've looked at how religious pluralism numbs people from discussing anything serious about religion or Christianity. We've looked at that simple sample 30-second response just to get the ball rolling. Now I'm going to spend the rest of the time just unpacking that 30-second response from what Jesus says. So Jesus, there are three things I want to point out about that 30-second response. So I'll put it up again later at the end of the thing. If you're writing it down or taking photos, it's okay. It'll come up again. The first thing Jesus claims is that he claims to be the only way to God. In John chapter 14, verse 6, Jesus says, I am the way, the truth, and the life. No one comes to the Father except through me. Now that's a very simple, uncomplicated statement. But it's also a very absolute statement, and quite an unfriendly one and non-politically correct one in today's society. But it's really interesting to note that religious pluralism is not a new phenomenon. It's been around for a very, very long time. In Jesus' time and in the times of the apostles, that's 2,000 years ago, in the time of the Greco-Roman world, that world was a melting pot of many, many different religions, probably more so than today. Paul in Acts chapter 17 said that the Athenians were very religious, and he even found an altar to an unknown god. In India and around India, Hinduism, one of the great main active world religions, has been around for more than 5,000 years. And Hinduism teaches that there are many different gods and many different ways to heaven. So Jesus' statement is radical. When he says, I am the way, the truth, and the life, no one comes to the Father except through me, that is radical. Radical 2,000 years ago and radical today. Because Jesus' claim is absolute. This claim is not relative or subjective. It's not subjective like, it's true for you and kind of true for you, but not true for me. It's not trying to work out what the best colour on earth is, or the best kind of car to drive, or the best phone to have, or the best food to eat. They're all subjective things. Well, Jesus is claiming to be the truth for every single body. Jesus is claiming to be the only way to God for every single body, an absolute thing. And if you look with me at Luke chapter 13, verses 23 onwards, Someone asked Jesus, "Lord, are only a few people going to be saved?" He said to them, "Make every effort to enter through the narrow door, because many, I tell you, will try to enter and will not be able to. Once the owner of the house gets up and closes the door, you will stand outside knocking and pleading, 'Sir, open the door for us.' But he will answer, 'I don't know you or where you come from.' Then you will say, 'We ate with you and drank with you and you taught in our streets.' But he will reply, 'I don't know you or where you come from. Away from me, you evildoers.' There will be weeping there and gnashing of teeth when you see Abraham, Isaac and Jacob and all the prophets in all the kingdom of God, but you yourselves are thrown out." Now, according to Jesus, the door to God's kingdom is actually quite narrow. There are not many who will enter. There are not many ways in. The only way is via true knowledge of Jesus. And the knowledge Jesus is talking about is not cerebral or head knowledge. It's not facts or figures. It's not even knowing the Bible back to front. It's not even knowing the Bible in its original language. That's not it. It's not superficial knowledge. You see, in verse 26, these people talked with Jesus, ate and drank with him, and listened to his teaching and shared his heritage. That wasn't even deep enough to know Jesus. True knowledge of Jesus in the context of Luke's gospel has to do with a deep trust and real recognition of Jesus as the Son of God. A real personal relationship with him that means that our lives will be radically transformed by this relationship. This passage in Luke 13 is a real wake-up call for every single person in this room, because the door to God's kingdom is narrow. So just going through the motions is not going to do it for you. It's not going to work. Going through the motions, somehow glibly pretending that that's a real relationship with Jesus, that's not going to do it. Coming to church every week, giving to church regularly, saying your prayers, doing the sacraments like baptism and communion. As important and as great as each of these things are, none of them will actually save you. The only thing that will save us is a deep, authentic trust and love and relationship with Jesus Christ. All the rest we do because they kind of demonstrate that relationship, but they're not a substitute for that relationship. And what's more, in verse 25, one day the owner will get up and shut that narrow door shut, and it will be too late. So it's only through a personal relationship with God that we can enter God's kingdom, and that narrow door is not open forever. Which brings us to the second point. Jesus claims to be God incarnate. So the first point is that Jesus claims to be the only way to God. The second point is Jesus claims to be God coming in the flesh. So when you read from John chapter 14, verse 8, Philip says, "Lord, show us the Father, and that will be enough for us." Jesus answered, "Anyone who has seen me has seen the Father. How can you say, 'Show us the Father'? Don't you believe that I am in the Father and the Father is in me? The words I say to you are not just my own, rather, it is the Father living in me who is doing his work." Now, Jesus' claim here that he is God incarnate is extraordinary. He's not claiming to be a mouthpiece of God or the prophet of God or revealing something of God's truth to us. Muhammad called himself a prophet. Buddha claimed to have discovered the path of enlightenment. Moses and Elijah and all those other guys in the Old Testament, they claim to be prophets of God. But here, Jesus is being very different. Jesus is claiming to be God. That his very person is the revelation of God. So when we see Jesus, we are seeing God. When we listen to Jesus and read his words, we're hearing God. When we know Jesus, we know God. That claim is unique amongst all world religions. No one else has the audacity to claim such a thing, nor do they have the proof to back that kind of claim up. And you see, what Jesus is claiming here means that there is no excuse to be agnostic. There's no excuse to say, well, I just wasn't sure, therefore I couldn't commit. There's no point trying to gather up all the evidence of God's existence by looking everywhere else, trying to make up theories about your observation of what God could or couldn't be. If God has revealed himself, that is God. It's kind of like trying to work out my middle name. Some of you guys know my middle name. Some of you may not. That's okay. But I'm pretty confident that a million of you, over a million days with a million questions each, would never work out my middle name. I'm pretty confident. Do you want to know what it is? Okay. My middle name on my driver's license is Chicken. Do you know what I mean? Like, you would never have worked that out, would you? You would never have got it from observation. You would never have got it just from talking to me and somehow trying to derive it from my essence. I don't know what a small location. But unless I revealed my middle name to you, unless I directly told you that crucial bit of information, you would never, ever know. And it's the same with God. It's the same with God. We can make every single guess from our observations of creation, but the crucial information comes from direct revelation from God himself. Jesus claims to be the direct revelation of God. He claims to be God who's revealed himself by personally stepping into our world and introducing himself to us. You kind of can't be any clearer than that. And what convinces me to believe Jesus is that his words are backed up by his actions. In the accounts of Jesus' life, in the Bible, and even in the extra biblical material like Josephus, and the Roman historians, Jesus lived a life that was blameless. No one can point to anything that he did that was morally wrong. He did miracles that were superhuman. He healed the sick. He calmed the storm. He exorcised demons. He raised the dead, and he predicted future events with 100% accuracy. But the most convincing of all was the fact that he rose again from the dead, never to die again. So at the end of the day, if all the things that he did whilst on earth were true, and that his words were miraculously backed up by his actions, then it gives me and it gives you confidence that all his claims were true, including the claim that he has that he is God coming in the flesh. So the first point is Jesus is the only way to God. The second one is Jesus claims to be God incarnate. And the third thing about that 30-second answer is Jesus claims universal authority. In Luke 13, Jesus was asked in verse 23, Lord, are only a few people going to be saved? If you skim down to verse 28, there will be weeping there and gnashing of teeth where you see Abraham, Isaac and Jacob and all the prophets in the kingdom of God, but you yourselves thrown out. People will come from east and west and north and south and will take their place at the feast in the kingdom of God. The entrance into the kingdom of God is not based on race or culture or merit or intelligence or looks. Jesus was speaking to the Jews at the time. He told them that their ancestral fathers would be in the kingdom, but they would not because they did not truly know Jesus. And on top of that, the great heavenly feast will be filled with people not just of Jewish origin, but people from the north and south, the east and the west, from every part, from every corner, from every tribe on earth. So much so that in Revelation chapter 7, verse 9, this is is a description of what heaven's like. There before me was a great multitude that no one could count, from every nation, tribe, people, language, standing before the throne and in front of the Lamb. Regardless of our cultural background, regardless of our skin colour or language that we speak, as long as we truly trust and follow Jesus, then there is a place reserved for you in heaven. There is a place reserved for you at that heavenly feast on that last day that goes forever. So it boils down to whether you believe and trust and follow Jesus or not. So what would you say when someone says, all roads lead to heaven? I understand what you're saying, but I just want you to know that as a Christian, I don't think we know it all. Not at all. We simply look at Jesus' life and find ourselves convinced by what he did and taught. Jesus has made some unique claims. He was once asked by a friend about the way to God, and he said, I am the way, the truth, and the life. No one comes to the Father except through me. And later on he said, if you've seen me, you've seen the Father. Jesus alone, of all the great religious founders, said that he himself was a revelation of God. That means that people don't have to rely on religion or guesswork. They can just look at Jesus' life and see what God is like. For me, that's what separates Jesus and Christianity from all other religions.